So I met Jim this afternoon. I'm going to put this up just a little bit more. Met Jim this afternoon, and what a great, very peaceful guy. We were talking together, and a bee came over to the table right out there, and it came on Jim's hand, and he just played with it and put it right out the door. Years and years of service, and without further ado, here's Jim.
My name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for that really great introduction. The beekeeper, I didn't even know. First off, Don, thank you so much for asking me to come and be with y'all tonight. He asked me like a year ago, and I've never been asked to speak that far in advance. I'm usually like, you know how it is in AA. It's like, hey, man, we got a meeting in 3 minutes. Can you speak? So I really know how to act, you know. Thank you for that very much. It's a real privilege to be here with all of y'all. And I have to make a small disclaimer before I start. I'm suffering from a pretty severe case of sleep deprivation right now. My wife and I just got a new puppy about 2 weeks ago. And he goes to the bathroom every 2 to 3 hours. And it's my choice as to whether that occurs outside or inside. So I've been choosing for outside, and it's working out really well, except it's kind of cutting into my sleep. So I had a nice trip over from Athens today. I'm so tired, the traffic didn't even faze me. I don't care. I simply don't care. But you know, Athens is often referred to as a football town with a drinking problem. And which is actually a good deal. Because 3 years ago, before Kirby Smart got here, we were a drinking town with a football problem. This is much preferred. First things first, my sobriety date is August 1st, 2007. And my home group is the usual suspects group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's coming up on its one-year anniversary. We wanted to start a literature meeting in Athens. And so the first Wednesday of the month, we do a big book study. The second Wednesday is a tradition study. The third Wednesday is a concept study. And the fourth Wednesday is an AA history study. And if we have a fifth, it's a secret. So, no discussion meetings whatsoever. We read the literature, we share about the literature, and it's working out really, really well. We've had to already move from a smaller room into a bigger room to accommodate people, which kind of caught me off guard. But anyway, if you're ever in Athens on a Wednesday night, come to the 24th Street Clubhouse, and it's a very different kind of meeting. We have a lot of fun there. I have a sponsor. His name is David Kidd. And David is, he's the best. He's just the best. I was reading, when I was new, I was reading that pamphlet, which I know is rare that new people read pamphlets. But anyway, there's a pamphlet called Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. And I think it's the bottom of the second page. It's the part about where you're looking for a sponsor, how to acquire a sponsor. And it says, try to find someone who's at least a year away from their last drink and seems to really be enjoying their sobriety. And David was the guy. He was always having a good time. And I didn't understand how you could not drink and have a good time. And so I picked him. And we've been together for 12 years now. And it's been great. So I love him dearly. He's he's a bit of a smart aleck, and he's always like this far from getting in trouble. That he never manages to get in trouble. And I figured, you know what, if he can teach me how to do that, that would be really helpful. I'm a cross the line kind of guy. Anyway, I was up at Lake Lanier about 6 or 7 years ago, and I was listening to one of my favorite speakers. It was Woodstock of the South, and it was Polly Pistol.
Yeah.
And Polly said something that really touched me. She said, The chains of alcoholism were too soft to be felt until they became too strong to be broken. And that really, really struck a chord with me. The reason is I drank 31 years. The first 25 were quite nice. No real consequences, no... Well, one trip to jail. First time's really not a consequence. You know, I hear people sometimes sit in meetings and say, you know, my worst day sober was better than my best day drunk. That has not been my experience. I wouldn't trade 1978 for anything in this time. And let's face it, if we're in here, it's because drinking did something for us. It did something probably magical, I suspect. I've been restless, irritable, discontent my whole life. My sponsor's famous for saying, well, I never took a drink in kindergarten, but I sure could have used one. I identify with that. Yeah. You know, kindergarten was unbelievably uncomfortable. And it got worse after that. When I drank, it gave me courage. It just made me feel like I fit in. It took that restless, irritable, discontent thing. It just went away. I could go out and play. It really changed stuff for me. It's like I'd be an idiot not to do it. Interestingly enough, somewhere along about the time of, say, 2004 or something like that, it started to change for me. And I'm not going to go into why, but it just changed. My wife and I, we met in Raleigh and dated and got married in 1993. And so we would have a cocktail at night, kind of like normal couples do, you know. And around 2004, I started just drinking a little bit more. It was a very gradual thing. And so I started drinking a little bit more. And at one point, my wife said to me, Jim, she said, you know, you seem to be drinking a little bit more than you used to. I don't know. Is there something wrong? No, I'm good. So I said, you know what? I think I'll link myself to two every night. And what happened was I went from a Rocks glass to a Collins glass to an iced tea glass. But by God, it was only two. And what happened was, prior to our marriage, I was very much a workaholic. Serious type A OCD go get 'em personality. You know, the dangerous kind. And so I would shut down my drinking at night in order to be able to get up and put a coat and tie on and go to work the next morning, because that was important to me. And we ended up, the company we worked for in Raleigh, we ended up both resigning and moving to Athens and starting our own business. And so all of a sudden, I didn't have to get up in the morning and put a coat and tie on anymore and go report to a boss, because I was the boss. And this is probably not a good situation for somebody like me to be in, because I would drink more at night, and then I would be a little bit more hungover in the morning. And so I figured out pretty quickly that a Bloody Mary in the morning does wonders for a hangover. As long as my wife doesn't see me do it. So I became an early riser. I'd get up, sneak into the kitchen, mix the Bloody Mary right quick. I was a bartender in college, so I knew all the tricks. And drink it down, and I would be fine. And the only problem with this strategy is that about 11 o'clock, the hangover comes back with a vengeance. So then I got to do it again. And about 2:30, the hangover comes back again with a vengeance, and I got to do it again. And then 5 o'clock rolls around, it's cocktail hour, so we're good to go for the rest of the day there. And so this starts repeating itself over and over, day after day, very, very gradually. At some point, I became physically addicted to the alcohol. And at that point, I could not go more than 2 to 3 hours without a drink, without this starting. The shakes, the sweats. Y'all know what I'm talking about. And even though it was very subtle, it was definitely happening. And I couldn't function at work anymore. I was drinking probably a quart of Stolichnaya every day. On good days, a liter. My wife didn't understand. I did not understand alcoholism either. But the whole time I was doing this, and this went on for about a 2 or 3 year period, the whole time I was doing this, it never once occurred to me that getting up in the morning and taking a drink day after day after day might be abnormal. I know none of y'all did that. But see, that's the disease of alcoholism. That's that we can't distinguish the truth from the false. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one, because of course it does, because that's all I know. I got to the point where personal hygiene sort of went by the wayside. I quit bathing. I quit shaving. I quit brushing my teeth. I quit doing it. I just didn't care. I just didn't care. And apparently my wife took offense to this. Because at some point she said, you know what? I think it would be a really good idea if you moved upstairs into the guest bedroom. Which I thought was a phenomenal idea. I'm in the bed next to her, and I wake up at 2 o'clock, and I'm shaking, and I'm sweating, and I've got a handle of Stolies underneath the bed, and I've got to get that out, get the top off it, not slosh it inside the bottle, get 3 slugs in me, and keep it down, and then put it back without waking her up. That was tough. So I moved upstairs like that. We had a dog at the time. His name was Mosby. He was sort of half, well, 3/4 black lab, and had a little chow, and that purple on his tongue. That's how I knew it was chow. And Mosby weighed about 95 pounds. He was a big dog, and so me and Mosby moved into the upstairs bedroom together, which he thought was the greatest deal he'd ever seen, because he got to sleep on the bed, and he wasn't the worst smelling thing in the room. I'm a page 22 guy. I have bottles stashed all over the house. It's spinning out of control. And on June 29th, 2007, my wife was suffering in those days from what I like to call untreated Al-Anonism. She thought she was helping me out. And I get it. My wife's a dear lady. She's now the Al-Anon state delegate. So she figured it out pretty quick. But anyway, I have bottles all over everywhere, hidden here, there, everywhere. And so Barbara would get them and either pour most of it out and leave about that much in the bottom, just enough for me to get a taste, or she would pour it out and fill it up with water. Like I wasn't going to notice. Right? Yeah. You get it. Anyway, Barbara made a huge score on my vodka stash one Friday morning and dumped out a lot of very expensive vodka. And I was in tears. And I just said, you know what? There's no way I make it through the rest of the day, much less the entire weekend. So I get in my car, and I go. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I go to the liquor store, buy 2 more handles, convinced I'm going to hide them better. And on the way home, I get a DUI. In my own neighborhood. Called in by one of my neighbors. Love that guy. So anyway, Athens Clark County police officer says, Mr. Turner, would you be willing to do a breathalyzer? And I said, absolutely, sir. And so he had the machine up. I blew in it. What I didn't realize is he turned it off when it passed 0.3. He said, I'm going to need to get you to do a field sobriety test. And I started laughing. And he said, what's so funny? I said, officer, I've fallen down in front of you 3 times. Did I know one? Just take me to jail. And he did. And I remember riding in the police car going to jail going, maybe this is finally the end. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is it. And I had like a little bit of hope. And my wife, the untreated Al-Anon, shows up and bails me out, lickety-split. If I was her, I'd have let me stay in there and think about it for a while, but that's what she did in those days. So I got home, and guess what the first thing I did was when I got home? Turned up a bottle of Stoli's. But that's my coping mechanism. That is all I got. So anyway, I think my final blood alcohol level was 0.38. And I'm thinking, you know, you better be glad you caught me at 2 o'clock, not 5 o'clock, you know. It scared the hell out of me. And I said, maybe this is it. And so I got a lawyer. And I talked to him, and he checked into it. And he called me, and he said, okay, look. He goes, your blood alcohol level was ridiculous. He goes, they're going to have a field day with you, even though it's your first offense. They're going to have a field day with you. So we're going to need to be proactive. And so what I'm going to need to get you to do is I want you to go ahead, stop drinking, number one. Number two, I want you to sign up for DUI school. You need to go ahead and get that certificate. Take it into court with us. It'll look better. I said, okay. Fortunately, about 6 months prior to this time, when he told me to stop drinking, I had convinced my doctor that I was suffering from a very severe benzodiazepine deficiency. And he prescribed Ativan. So I would take 2 Ativan and drink a liter of vodka and black out. Every time. Every time. So I continued to take the Ativan after I quit drinking, which turns out benzos are wonderful detox drugs, wonderful anticonvulsants. You'd probably have a different speaker up here tonight had I not done that. So I'm one of these people where I don't really have to know a lot about anything to be an expert on it. You only know people like that? I quit drinking for 10 days. I got my little DUI certificate. And I got to thinking about it. I was going, you know, I don't really know what an alcoholic is, but I'm very certain they can't go 10 days without drinking. Therefore, I can't possibly be an alcoholic. So what I'm going to do is, and I made the solemn oath, I will never, ever, 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 ever get in the car and drive it again after I've been drinking. I've got a DUI, hadn't even gone to court yet. That's crazy. No way I do that. Solemn oath. Meant it with every fiber of my being. So I had a drink with my wife that night. 4 days later, I'm drinking a quart of vodka again, driving drunk. If that's not powerlessness, I do not know what is. My dad called me on July 31st, and he said, I need you to go over to my house and do some work. And he was out of town, And I said, okay, sure. And what I did was I went over to his house and I worked over the liquor cabinet pretty heavy. And I got in my truck and drove home. And when I got home, I got out of the truck and I saw a dent. A dent. A sizable dent. A sizable dent that had not been there earlier in the day. Everything I'm doing now, I'm in a blackout. I can't remember anything. It's just lost. And I got to thinking. I said, I wonder what the hell I hit. I hit something pretty hard. I hope it wasn't a big dog or something. God, I hope it wasn't a human. Oh my God, I hope it wasn't a child. And I came out of a blackout like that and had my moment of clarity. And what came through to me was, you were not put here on this earth to harm anything or anyone. And look at yourself. Look what you're doing. I have no idea how my wife was suffering. She's asking herself, how can I be such a horrible wife to where he wants to drink himself to death like this? It never crossed my mind one time that my drinking was affecting and harming others until that very instant. And I decided that day right there, okay, this is it. This has got to stop. This cannot go on. I can't live like this anymore. And so the only place I've been able to stay sober was in the Clark County Jail. I'm not real thrilled with that place at the moment. So I put myself in treatment. Started treatment, and the very next day, as a matter of fact. And on the first day, I vaguely remember this. This was an outpatient treatment center, so you could go home at night, which I thought was a good deal. The first day we had lunch, and they said, okay, everybody get in the car. And I said, where are we going? And they said, we're going to AA. And I said, I'm not going to AA. No one mentioned AA. I checked into this place. I may not remember much, but I'll remember that. You got to understand, this is where I was. So, on that day, my hair is falling out. And I'm skinny now. I weigh 25 pounds less than I do right now. I look like a skeleton with skin on it. My liver enzymes were through the roof. I had bruises on my face and my arms and my chest and my knees. I fell down a lot. I like to think of it as being gravitationally challenged. It was awful. I literally looked like a dead person. It was awful. So they made us go to AA. And in this treatment center, the way it works is it's a 6-week program. And what they do is they urge you to get a home group, get a sponsor, start working the steps. We will consider you graduating. And after a few weeks in there, I thought graduation was a really good idea. I was into that. Now, the interesting thing is about this time, I started going to AA. I did not have the gift of desperation. I had the gift of exhaustion. I was so tired from drinking and drugging literally around the clock, keeping the supply going. It was awful. It was work. It was drudgery. Hated it. But I could not do it. So I'm tired. I'm not really arguing with anybody at this point. Kind of like tonight. I was sitting in an AA meeting, and I remember reading the steps on the wall. And I got step 2. I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. And I thought, you know, I got a bad feeling. I think I know where this is going. And I read step 3. And I thought, damn, there it is. And so I remember going back to the treatment center. It was a noon meeting. I remember going back to the treatment center, and my counselor took one look at me, and he said, "What is wrong with you?" And I said, I can't do this. And he said, "Why not?" And I said, I can't do the God thing. And he said, "Why not?" When I was a little boy, this is early 1960s, I got molested by a priest. And I went home and I told my parents what happened. And they were doing the best they could. It was not cool to say anything back in those days. And what they told me was, "Jimmy, you can never tell anyone about this as long as you live. This will bring shame to our family." And I'm thinking, I didn't do a damn thing wrong. And so I stuck that very deeply inside me. And this is how I know I'm an alcoholic. What I got was resentment. I don't know regular human beings get resentments. I get that. But I did not get a resentment against this old man. I got a resentment against all of organized religion. Every bit of it. I didn't want any part of it. And for the next 45 years, I was all alone. I was on my own, and I was okay with that. I was not an atheist. That's entirely too much work. Oh, you mean I got to disprove the existence of God? I think I'll opt for the agnostic thing. That seems a lot easier, you know. I don't care. And so when I came into AA, I was an agnostic with a bad attitude. And I remember my counselor said, "Jim, you're confused here, buddy." He said, "You think that AA is a religious program, and it's not. It's a spiritual program." And I said, "What the hell's the difference?" He said, "Come here." So he took me in his office, and he printed this thing off the internet. And since it came to the internet, I know it had to be true. It was a quote from the Dalai Lama. And he was comparing and contrasting spirituality and religion. And he handed this to me, and I read it, and I cannot quote it word for word. I'll tell you the gist of it. It said, there is a distinction to be made between spirituality and religion. He said, "Religion I take to be associated with one faith tradition or another, usually involving some metaphysical or supernatural being, belief in a salvation or a nirvana, coupled with prayer, ritual, and dogma. Spirituality, on the other hand, I take to be associated with those basic qualities of the human spirit, like love, like compassion, like tolerance, like acceptance, patience, the sense of harmony, the sense of responsibility. This is why I believe that these human qualities can be developed to a great extent without any recourse whatsoever to any religion." And I read that and I went, that's it. That sounded really cool to me, and it opened the door that far. That is all I needed. All I needed. My world changed that day. It completely changed. And my buddy Earl here was talking about the bee out there. The reason I let the bee come onto my finger and eventually took him outside, and it wasn't him, and let it go. I don't pick up your old bees. It goes back to I can't harm anything or anyone to this day. I've been able to stay true to that. I don't care what it is. I won't even step on an ant. And I know that's weird, but that's me. So I got into the step work. I remember doing my fourth step. Got some extremely valuable information out of that. I learned, believe it or not, that I have a high opinion of myself. Unrealistically so. I also learned that every decision I made my entire life, up to about 5 years ago, was based in fear. I have a failed marriage to thank for that, because I didn't want to grow old and be alone. Afraid. I'm afraid of everything. I'm terrified. But I learned a lot about fear. We talk a lot about fear here, right? I mean, you want a meeting where there's no dead airspace? Choose fear as your topic. What I learned is that fear is a good thing. Fear is actually a self-preservation technique. Animals love fear. It keeps them alive. We, however, as humans, we have things called past, presence, and futures. Animals do not. You might remember a glimpse of things here or there, but they do not. They're always in the net. Right? Which is why I love dogs. It's always their favorite time to do something. As long as it's not on the den road. What I learned about fear is very temporal. And what I mean by that is that all the time when I can stay present, like I am with y'all right now, I may be afraid, but it will not paralyze me. Not one bit. If you get me in the past, or particularly get me off in the future somewhere, and that fear of the unknown kicks in, I will flip out. And I will make myself crazy. I actually have an Al-Anon sponsee who says, worry is a terrible waste of the imagination. Which I think is spot on. That is so right on. And I've learned that if I will keep my brain in the same time zone as my posterior, things are a lot easier. And so whenever I'm scared, whenever I feel that fear come in, I always have to ask myself, are you okay right now? Do you have oxygen? Do you have access to water? Do you know where your next meal is coming from? Do you know where you're going to sleep tonight? Is it warm? Is it safe? And if the answer to all of those are yes, which they always are, I'm okay. I'm okay. So fear does not derail me like it one time did. My sponsor used the seven deadly sins when we were doing to do the character defects, you know. I prefer to call them the seven toxic emotions. Same thing. Anyway, when we got through with my fifth step, I was thrilled that there was only seven of them. Because it's like, every time, you know, I remember one point I go, I can't be gluttonous, look at me. I can tread water in a garden hose, I can't be. He goes, Jim, gluttony is just another word for overconsumption. Did you ever overconsume anything? Gotcha, David. We did step 6 and 7 sitting in the cab of my truck, sitting outside his home group one night. Took about, I don't know, 12 minutes, something like that. And I started making my 8-step list, made my amends list. Ended up with 36 people after we pared it down. That was my sponsor. We pared it down. So I had 36 people, so I started making my amends. And he sat me down and he said, Jim, he goes, these are not apologies, these are amends. I will not tolerate you saying I'm sorry to anyone. Trust me, they already know how sorry you really are. I want you to tell them I was wrong. He goes, this is supposed to humble you. You tell them I was wrong and you find out what you can do, if anything, to set things right. And I said, yes, sir. I made amends to my dad and my wife first, because they were the people that I hurt the worst. They were my only family. I neglected to say I'm an only child, but my mom passed away in 01, so it's just me and dad. That was it. And of course, Barbara took the brunt of it. And I really, really made solid amends to them. And I started going after these people, and I got it whittled down to 9 people. Could not find these 9 people anywhere. Got everybody else, just not these 9. By this time, I had been invited to move back downstairs out of the guest bedroom. I was sleeping in the big bed again. And we were laying there one night, it was a Thursday night, Friday morning, middle of the night, and the phone rang, and I opened one eye, and I looked at the caller ID on the phone, and it said, Athens Regional Medical Center. And I thought, this is probably not good news. And I answered the phone, and they said, is this James Turner? And I said, yes, it is. And he said, your father has had a massive brain hemorrhage, and he is in the emergency room, and you need to get here right now. And I said, okay. I did not have a driver's license because of the DUI. And Barbara said, what was that all about? And I told her, and I said, would you drive? She said, yes, of course I'll drive you down. And we got dressed and went down to the hospital, and he was slipping into a coma right about the time we got there. And I told him I loved him, and I don't know if he heard it or not. And he had about between a 6 and 7 centimeter hemorrhage right in the middle of his brain. So there was nothing they could do, because they would destroy more tissue trying to get to it. So it was basically inoperable. So they got him stabilized, and they moved him up to neuro ICU. And my greatest fear in my life was losing my dad. He had been there every day of my life. Now, he was not real happy with me during the last years of my drinking, mind you. But he was there. He loved me, and I loved him. I didn't know what to do. I was 4 days shy of a yellow chip, and in Athens, a yellow chip is 6 months. So I'm not mentally, emotionally, or spiritually prepared for this kind of stuff happening. It was interesting that week. So 6 days went by while he was in hospital. His kidneys started to fail. And I had his living will in my pocket. And I knew what it said. It said, if I'm incapacitated, no food, no water, no meds, no oxygen. And as he lay there, I was like, I got to do something. He was dating this lady. And I went up to her. And I said, I've got his living will. I think I need to ask them to remove the life support. I don't think this is going to get any better. And the lady said, you can't kill him. You can't kill him. And I thought, ugh. And I said, okay. So 6 days went by. And on the sixth day, I knew that it was time. And I just said, this has got to stop. And I went to the staff and I said, you're going to have to take the life support, I'm sorry. And they said, no, that's it. And so me and my wife and my sponsor sat in that room with him while they unplugged everything. And we sat there over a couple of hours, and the needles and gauges went down and down and down. And he was gone. Here's why I tell you that story. You remember those 9 people I couldn't find? During those 6 days, all 9 of those people came to the hospital. And I would say, you know, there's an empty waiting room over there. Could I have 5 minutes of your time? I promise it won't take long. And they said, sure. And so I finished my amends that week. And so when my dad departed this earth, I was done. Now, I don't know. I'm not an odds maker. I don't know what the odds are of something like that happening. But I strongly suspect they're not that damn good. It was amazing. But I always wondered, did I do the right thing? Was that the right call? It was, you know, when that whole thing started, I was there, you know, God keep me sober in the morning and at night, God thank you for keeping me sober. That was the extent of my spirituality. I learned how to pray those 6 days. Well, I don't know if it was effective or not, but I learned what to do. And I think finally in the end, I got the answer. This young lady came up to me about a year later. And she said, I'm going to celebrate a year of sobriety at the Athens Young People's Group, and I would like for you to be our speaker. Would you do that? And I said, absolutely, I'll do that. And so I had never been to the Athens Young People's Group before. It's a wonderful little girl, you know, a bunch of college kids and stuff, and people that probably were too old, but go anyway. So I spoke that night, and I shared with the group what I just shared with y'all about my dad. And there was another lady that night, young lady that was celebrating 7 years, and her dad went to the podium after the meeting was, you know, doing the medallions. Her dad went to the podium, and he had her 7-year medallion. And we were all going out to eat sushi afterwards. And I had worked up a hell of an appetite. And I was pretty hungry. And I'm 1.5 years sober, so patience is not my long suit. So I'm sitting there going, he's standing there at the podium. I'm sitting about where Cherry is. And he's standing there, and he starts to cry. And I'm going, oh, God, it's 7 years. What's the... Come on. Give her the medallion, dude. This is how spiritual you're dealing with. And he looks at me and he says, I don't know if you know this or not, but I was one of your dad's doctors. And 2 days before he had that brain hemorrhage, he came to my office and we were talking and he said, you know what? I hope if something ever happens to me that my son has the courage to pull the plug. And I lost it. I'm crying. You know, this is the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. There's only two places that kind of stuff can happen. Number one is Alcoholics Anonymous, and number two is the Hallmark Channel. And they make that up. This is what we get here. This is what we get here. And you know, that stuff happens all the time. All we have to do is be awake and aware. It's amazing to me how often this kind of stuff happens. So I'm having a real hard time anymore with the agnostic thing. My sponsor made the suggestion, why don't you become a former agnostic? And I said, I think that's a really good idea. So I did. I want to finish up the last little bit talking about service. Service has been something that has made all the difference in the world for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12th step, you know, we have the circle and the triangle. Three legs of the triangle are three legacies: recovery, unity, and service. I think the 12th step is the only step that addresses all three legacies. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result, not one of many, the result of these steps. That's recovery. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. That's service. And practice these principles in all our affairs. That's unity. The whole package is right there. I remember I was leaving the Clark County Jail. I was about 2 months sober. I'd gone back in and gone to court and gotten sentenced. And so I was leaving the Clark County Jail after serving the balance of that DUI. And I remember I was walking up the ramp to the jail to the outer gate, and my wife was waiting in the parking lot. The thought crossed my mind that night. You know, I was like, you know what? The only time Barbara's ever been to jail is to get me out. And I said to myself, I said, you know what? I said, I'm sober now. I will never, ever, 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 ever come back in a place like this as long as I live. And apparently my higher power found that to be hilarious. Because not long later, I met my sponsor's home group, and this guy comes up to me after the meeting, and he goes, hey man, you want to help us carry meetings into the Clark County Jail? And in my mind, I hear, why in the hell would I ever want to do something like that? Out of my mouth comes, okay. That's about as spiritual as I get someday. Okay. So I filled out the paperwork. They turned it in. The jail lost it. I was ecstatic that my social security number was floating around the Clark County Jail. They said, we lost it. Fill it out again. Sure, I'll fill it out again. Fill it out again, turn it in, and I got approved. And I started going in and doing meetings in the jail. And it lit me up. It was the coolest thing I think I've ever done at that time. It was like, this is great. I felt passionately in love with it. You know, so every time there's a chance to take a meeting in, if there's an open slot, I'm there. And so I'm going in, doing this thing. I'm the kind of guy that, like, if you chain me to a desk, and it's my night to go into the jail, guess what? The desk is getting dragged in with me. It's that important to me. I love it. It just touches me. So, a few months later, we had a district election, and the district elections rep got elected alternate DCM. And so at the end of the meeting, they said, are there any announcements? And the incoming alternate DCM says, yeah, I can't be district corrections rep anymore. I think Jim should take over. And everybody voted me in. I didn't have a say-so in it whatsoever. And I said, okay, whatever. Yeah, I can do that. And about that time, I was coming up on 2 years. The day that I got my second blue chip, this is not a medallion, this is a blue chip, they said, are there any announcements in the GSR of our group? I was the alternate GSR. The GSR of the group says, yes, I'm stepping down effective immediately, and Jim will be taking over as GSR. And I'm going, okay, so this is how this works in AA. So I just sort of, in a weird way, got involved in service, you know. The next year we hosted the prepaid convention, the state convention in Athens, and I got to serve as the chairperson for registration. So we were down at assembly. I've been going to assembly for about a year. And if you've never been to an assembly, you should go. You really should go. My first assembly, I remember driving from Macon back to Athens, and I cried the whole way home. I was so touched, and just, it was amazing seeing all those people representing all those groups, and it was just cool. So I was down there signing people up. This was the September assembly. We were hosting the pre-K in October. So I'm signing people up, being a good boy, behaving myself. And Patty comes walking up, and I look at her, and I go, well, that's Patty. She's the delegate. I'm not really sure what a delegate does, but I know she's important. And she comes up, and she gets it one of these, right? Come here, come here. And I'm going, oh, I didn't do anything. You know, I was like freaked out. And I went up and I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, I was wondering if you'd be willing to serve as area co-chair for corrections. Your name was submitted. And I said, I don't think I have enough time. And she said, how much time have you got? And I said, 3 years. And she said, and Patty always carries a service manual. So she rips it out. She says, let's just check on that, Jim. It says here, 2 to 3 continuous years of sobriety in the state of Georgia. Sorry, Jim. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And so I got to spend the next 2 years as area co-chair and then 2 years as area chair. And it was one of the neatest things I got to do up to that point, because I got to go in way more men and women's prisons in the state of Georgia than I ever felt necessary. But it was really neat. We'd go in and meet with wardens, and where there weren't meetings, we'd get meetings started, and where there were meetings with problems, we'd try to get them straightened out. I learned to use the traditions and the concepts those 4 years. And it was practical application, and I don't know what I would have done without that, because it's currently finishing up as a DCM over in 16B. And now it's easy for me. Every time a group has a problem, it's like, well, there's a tradition or a concept that's going to address that, if not both, you know? And so it was really helpful. The last thing we don't want to talk about before I finish up is I was very, very fortunate to be able to serve as co-chair on the International Convention Host Committee in 2015 in Atlanta. I see Harold sitting there. He was on the committee. While I was area chair for corrections, I got to know a lady named Eva. And Eva worked the corrections desk at the, you know, Eva. You know Eva. So Eva was working the corrections desk, and then as soon as she finished that, she got put in charge of the 2015 International Convention. And so she and I talked on the phone. We never met, but we talked on the phone. It sort of become somewhat buddies. And anyway, she calls me, I think it was August of 2014, the convention was July 4th, 2015. And she says, hey, Jim, this is Eva Sanchez from GSO. How are you doing? I only know one Eva, you know, but she always introduces herself. She's always very formal, which is great. And I said, hey, Eva, how are you? She said, I'm good. She said, I need to talk to you about something. And I said, okay. And she said, but before I go any further, you need to promise me that you will never divulge to anyone the nature of our discussion. And I thought, what? Like, okay, sure, Eva. And she says, so, I'm interested in doing something that's never been done in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous before. She said, I would like to get an inmate, a Georgia inmate, released from prison for the day to speak at the International Convention. And I thought, my God, I'm on the phone with a crazy woman. I was like, Eva, I've never heard of the department doing something. I said, you know what? If you want to, I'm your boy. What the hell, right? And so anyway, we started working trying to identify an inmate, which we did. And we ended up asking a young man who I met in 2011. He came to the meetings in the prison where I was doing my meetings in Jackson County at the county prison house of state inmates. And so we approached him and asked him if he would be willing to do it. Now, this guy, he's got no clue what an international convention is. He's never been to an AA meeting outside of prison. And I'm like, are you sure about this, man? You know, but he's like, no, for what AA's given to me, I'll do anything you guys ask. Jason did the thing that I suspect we were all terrified of doing. In a blackout, Jason took the life of another human being in a car and got sentenced to 15 to 20 years through 15 for behavioral homicide. And this young man was, when I first met him in the meetings in the prison, he had a cloud of darkness over him, really, really bad. I mean, the guilt and the shame from that. He woke up chained to a gurney, handcuffed to a gurney in Grady Hospital. That's how he found out what he had done. So, we went to work, Eva at one point, we start working with the department and talking to them, and Eva at one point says, so Jim, she says, does Jason work the steps? And I said, how would I know? I just do the meetings, you know? And she goes, Jim, she goes, we cannot have someone speaking at the International Convention who has not worked the 12 steps about college 9. Good point, Eva. So we divided up the work. She was working with the department trying to get it cleared, and I started taking him through the steps. So he was actually not too far up the road from here at Walker State Prison. As a matter of fact, when I was driving in today, it reminded me of my trips that I would drive from Athens up to Walker. And I would go up there on the days, on on Saturdays where we didn't have host committee meetings at NABBA, I would drive up and do step work with him in the visitation lot. And there was always like 100 people in there, and it's loud, and it was not the most ideal step work conditions, but it's what you got, right? So I'd go up there and do step work with him. I remember the second time I went up to the prison, I would always wear my Department of Corrections badge. And so the second time I went up there, one of the female correctional officers goes, sir, you can come to the front of the line. And I'm like, okay. And this lady, probably some inmate's mom, she's tired of waiting in line, goes, why does he get to go to the front of the line? And the correctional officer says, because he's a pastor. I had to bite my lip. But I make it a personal policy never to argue with a correctional officer. So I went to the front line. But anyway, we ended up getting through the steps. And as it turned out, not many people know this, as it turned out, Commissioner Brian Owen of the Georgia Department of Corrections said, no, you cannot do this. But in the Department of Corrections, the warden always has the final say on everything that happens at their prison. And he overruled his boss. And he said, because the warden was the warden down at Lee State down in Southwest Georgia, and he was a super, super great friend of AA. And so we got a meeting started at the prison while Jason was there. But anyway, we got through with the steps, and it all got set. Everything got set up, and they did a trial run down there, and he was going to speak in the dump. And he did not know this, okay? I was under the impression, falsely, that he was going to speak in the World Congress Center in one of the smaller rooms. And Eva goes, no, Jim, he's going to speak in the dome. And I'm like, oh, no. Anyway, everything worked out. Were any of y'all in the Georgia Dome that Sunday morning? Oh, wow, look at this. All right. So y'all know what happened. That young man came in. I met him in the green room. And my job that morning was to keep him calm, which was great, except for I was really hoping there'd be somebody to keep me calm, too. Because I was freaking out. Now, I think when he pulled up to the dome, he was like, uh-oh. Maybe I should reconsider. But now, you know, he came in and we sat there, we prayed together, and we laughed and we talked, and I said, you know, you're going to do great. Because you got to understand something. He had never told his story before. This was the first time he was ever going to tell his story in front of probably 60,000 people in the Georgia Dome at the International Convention. So he would call me every day that week. He would call me. We could talk for 15 minutes, and then 15 minutes. And so he would call me, and I would listen to the story. I'd go, okay, that's good. That's good. He's that outfit, you know. So I would kind of coach him through. And so when he got up to the podium, I didn't really know what version he was going to do. And I did tell him, I said, so down on the floor, there's this digital timer. And when you start, it's going to say 20 minutes, and it's going to count down. You have got to be finished when it gets to zero. He says, okay. And I said, then you got to remember to breathe. I said, it's the first thing you did when you came into this world. It will be the last thing you do when you leave. It is a constant. It is a must. You have to breathe. And he went to the microphone and said, I'm Jason. I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, God, he forgot to breathe. But he did a phenomenal job. There was not a dry eye in the crowd. For those of you who are there, will probably never forget it. It was the most from the heart. He didn't know any other way to do it. It was not polished. It was not pretty. It was just from the heart. The language of the heart. And he did the story, and later on, Tom and Patty and I got to go up on the stage at the very closing part of the final meeting. And so as we walked off the stage, Jason and I just happened to match up together. He was wearing his inmate firefighter uniform. And we just happened to match up shoulder to shoulder. And we were walking off the stage, and I looked over at him and I said, "That's the single most courageous thing I've ever seen any human being do in my life." And I said, "You knocked it out of the park, buddy." And we got backstage and we hugged. And this, of course, his security detail was all there. And we hugged, and I looked at him and I said, "You know what? From now on, when you get asked to tell your story in AA, it's all downhill from here." "You have reached the pinnacle." His talks ended up selling more copies than all of the rest of the talks combined. That's what happens in AA. We know when it's coming from the heart. They had an ice cream social for us, and we left. I was trying to work my way out of there. I knew Barbara was somewhere in the dome. She was sitting with one of my sponsees and his wife, and we were supposed to meet over there at the World Congress Center. And I got up there, and I hadn't seen her since like 6:30 that morning. And I'm looking frantically. There's 1,000 people in this massive ballroom, and I'm looking, "Where is she? Where is she?" And finally, we catch each other's eye, and she comes running, and I start running, and we meet, and we just embrace, and I just started sobbing, and she just started sobbing, and she said in my ear, she said, "I am so proud of Jason. And I am so proud of you." And that right there, that was the most important part. Because we didn't have a marriage except on paper. It was awful. Bad. And the healing that had occurred during those 7 years was amazing to me. That made it, those simple words made the whole thing worthwhile. So I will finish right now. And I always like to leave with this story because we are not a glum lot. Amen. My wife and I, since I was about 3 years sober, had been invited to come into the treatment center where I was a client and tell our story together. And it's a 2-hour meeting. First hour is we do it together. What we were like, or what happened, what we're like. We're like, what happened, what we're like now. I'm really tired, y'all. And so we do our story together, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's really interesting because it's the same two people, the same house, but their perceptions are way different. It's really crazy. We actually got to do it down in Macon in July, and it was a lot of fun. And so then they take a break, and they come back in. Everybody comes back in. So you've got the clients in there, and they're really freaked out. Family members are in there with them. And so then they get to ask questions. And that's my favorite part of the whole thing is when they ask, because they ask some really great questions. And so this lady one night, she says, "Let me make sure I understand this." She said, "Jim, you still drink, or you don't drink. Barbara, you drink." And Barbara says, "Yeah, but, you know, not much." And she says, "Okay, if you don't drink and you still drink, how do y'all celebrate? How do you celebrate?" And I thought, damn good question. And I said, "Well, we just had our, I think it was 21st, whatever, wedding anniversary." And I said, "We went out to a really nice restaurant. She had 2 Cosmopolitans. I had 2 Dr. Peppers with cherries in them. That's how we celebrated." I said, "We had a great time." I said, "You gotta understand something. She's not an alcoholic. When she drinks, nobody dies. Nobody goes to jail. Never involves an ambulance." And my wife looks at her and she says, and I quote, "You see, when Jim drinks alcohol, bad things happen to Jim. When I drink alcohol, good things happen to you."
Thank you.
was mortified. We do not have the market on crazy cornered. It's the Al-Anons you have to really, really watch out for. Right? My life today is extraordinarily different than it was before I came in here. Nothing is the same. Thank God I didn't get my whole life back. I got a new life, an amazing life, a great one. I have the best marriage of anybody I know. There's love, there's kindness, there's courtesy, there's respect. There's laughter. There's a lot of laughter in our marriage. It's a great healer. I'm now an employee at the treatment center that I went through. I didn't go looking for a new career. They offered me a job. I said, what are you going to pay me? And they told me, and I said, okay. They actually pay me to bitch at newcomers for not working steps. Consider that. Great job. And I can't sponsor them. Great job. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me three things that I've always been looking for in my life. Never found it anywhere but here. Value, meaning, and purpose. Thank y'all so much. Y'all have been great.